Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Spirited Sports, episode number 51 for you today. In the National Hockey League, the NHL Stanley Cup Finals are approaching here, and it is Panthers-Oilers 2. The National Hockey League has announced the schedule for the 2025 Stanley Cup Finals, which will be a matchup between the Eastern Conference champions in the Florida Panthers against the Western Conference champs in the Edmonton Oilers, Game 1 on Wednesday, June 4th. So based on their superior regular season point totals, the Oilers will have home ice advantage playing games 1 and 2 at home in the best of 7 series and potentially games 5 and 7 if necessary. The Panthers will host games 3 and 4 and potentially game 6 in Florida if necessary. Each game in the 2025 Stanley Cup Finals will begin at 8 p.m. Eastern. So looking back to last season's Stanley Cup Finals, the first rendition of this classic matchup, the Oilers looked down and out in last season's Cup Final before rallying back from a 3-0 deficit to force a Game 7, and the decisive game did come down to the slimmest of margins, with Sam Reinhart's second period goal standing as the winner in a 2-1 victory for a Florida team with their first Stanley Cup championship. Had the Oilers managed to complete the comeback, they would have been the first Canadian team to win the Stanley Cup since 1993, and just the fifth team and second in the Stanley Cup final history to come back from a 3-0 series deficit. The Panthers have built their identity around a hard-hitting team, a very physical style of hockey with the likes of Sam Bennett, Listerainen, Brad Marchand patrolling the ice, and the physical Panthers lead the playoffs in both hits and penalty minutes with 812 hits and 279 penalty minutes. The Oilers can also throw the body around and are second with hits. Sam Bennett leads the playoffs with 10 goals, but the Panthers have had offensive contributions throughout the lineup. 19 players on their roster have scored in the postseason, and their defense has been responsible for 15 goals in 17 games. While the Panthers are known for their depth, 19 players have also scored for the Edmonton Oilers during their playoff run. Not bad for a team once considered too reliant on their superstars of Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. The Panthers picked up some playoff grit and veteran savvy when they acquired Brad Marchand, the former Boston Bruins captain at the trade deadline. Marchand, who turns 37 earlier this month, helped the Bruins win the Stanley Cup in 2011 and is headed into his fourth final. Impressive, except when he stacked against a 40-year-old in Edmonton, Corey Perry. He's headed to his fifth final in 6 years. Well, he has come short in his last four Cup Finals. He helped Anaheim win it all back in 2007. We've been saying this for a long time now, but the state of Florida has been the undisputed center of hockey for the last few years since 2020. Teams from the Sunshine State have appeared in six straight Stanley Cup Finals, winning three so far, but the combined success of the Panthers and Bolts hasn't quite reached the level of the high-flying Oilers of the 80s, led by Wayne Gretzky, Marc Messier, and other superstars. Between the 1982-83 season and the 1989-90 season, the Oilers won five Stanley Cups and were runners-up another time, creating one of the most legendary dynasties the NHL has ever seen. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Toronto Maple Leafs here. I know last week we spoke about former president in Brandon Shanahan making his departure from the Toronto Maple Leafs. But we had a very interesting press conference with the current Leafs GM in Brad Treliving and a few interesting words that he said in a press conference this week. Let's talk about it here. So the quote here from Brad Treliving is as follows: "There are some DNA that has to change in our team. If you keep getting the same result, there are some DNA that needs to change. That's on me going forward. We've now started the planning, and it's early for putting a team together for the 2025-26 season." Let's break that down. So looking at the DNA of this franchise, everyone looks towards the core four or the core five of this Maple Leaf squad. So let's just look at the contract situation here. So for the captain, Austin Matthews, he's signed through the 2027-28 season. Forward John Tavares is another pending unrestricted free agent. Defenseman Morgan Rielly is signed through the 2029-2030 season. Forward William Nylander, who's entering the second season of his 8-year, $92 million contract with an average annual value of $11.5 million. He signed on January 8th of 2024. The only players that might be on the move here for the Maple Leafs, Mitch Marner and John Tavares, were unrestricted free agents. For Morgan Rielly, there were kind of rumblings that, you know, he might be in the move after some inconsistencies this season, but, you know, he is kind of locked in here with the Maple Leafs, has a no-movement clause, so I don't think he wants to go. I don't think the team wants to see him go, so I think Rielly is here to stay for the Maple Leafs. So we've heard about the rumors of Mitch Marner, whether he stays in Toronto or goes somewhere else, whether he hits the free agent market on July 1st, whether he signs a contract with the Toronto Maple Leafs. A whole slew of scenarios have been, you know, talked about. But even with John Tavares as well, you know, his contract is up and he's an unrestricted free agent. So we'll see between the two of them what happens. But for John Tavares, he's 34 years old, has played the last seven seasons with the Maple Leafs after signing a massive seven-year, $77 million contract on July 1st in 2018. He played his first nine seasons in the NHL with the New York Islanders after they made him the first overall pick in the 2009 NHL draft. One thing that Brad Treliving did say that is that he would like to get a contract done with Matthew Knies as soon as possible. Another potential restricted free agent for the Toronto Maple Leafs, but the 22-year-old forward in Knies was selected by the Maple Leafs in the second round, 57th overall in the 2021 NHL draft, and had an NHL career high of 58 points, 29 goals, and 29 assists this season, and 7 points, 5 goals, and 2 assists in 13 playoff games. Change for the Maple Leaf core could finally become a reality this offseason, as Marner and Tavares are both pending unrestricted free agents. A lot going on here in Toronto, a lot of uncertainty when it comes to the core of this franchise.
Some changes I think the Leafs need to make this offseason is one. Once hailed as a hometown hero, Marner now represents everything that's gone wrong in Toronto's pursuit of playoff glory. The fans have turned, and even if he stays, the pressure he'd be playing under would be too immense to get the best version of him over the next eight seasons. Despite playing alongside Austin Matthews, arguably the best pure goal scorer of this generation, Marner has only one 100-point season and a playoff resume filled with underwhelming performances. If he didn't get it done then, why would anyone believe he could get it done while carrying around the pressure of a $13 million contract on his back? He was booed off the ice after another Game 7 collapse, and many fans will remember his tenure for contract disputes, off-ice drama, and repeated failures in high-pressure moments. With Marner potentially leaving, the Leafs also need to find a playoff warrior. One name that stands out is Sam Bennett, a free agent who was just helped eliminate the Leafs as part of Florida's relentless forward group. He's precisely the type of player Toronto has lacked, someone who finishes checks, agitates opponents, and scores when it counts. Whether it's through free agency or a bold trade, the Leafs must find their playoff soldier and someone to fill the leadership void that Matthews, Nylander, and Tavares haven't been able to do. If Mitch Marner does return to the Toronto Maple Leafs next year, I think he'll sign an 8-year deal worth $12 or $12.5 million a year. That is definitely going to be a hometown discount if he chooses to stay, but I don't think he's going to be a Toronto Maple Leaf next year. I think he's going to command $13 to $14 million a year in open market, and I think some team will give it to him. I think John Tavares' next contract will be 3 years at $5.5 to $6 million a year with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Tavares, who is 34 years old, had a good regular season with the Leafs, scoring 38 goals and 36 assists with a total of 74 points in 75 games played. You could argue his playoff performance was below average, but you could say that about the rest of the core too. A 3-year deal would lock him up till he's 37 to 38 years old, which I believe is a term he's looking for. I also believe he will take a discount to stay in Toronto, which will end up around the $5.5 to $6 million yearly average. If John chooses to go somewhere else in free agency, I think that AAV number will be higher at about $7 to $8 million per year with a 3 to 4-year term.
Alrighty, sticking to the theme of hockey here, let's bring in special guest Elias Drakos. Elias, thank you so much for making the time to be with us here today. So, question number one, why do or don't you think the Habs should or shouldn't trade away Mike Matheson?
Hey guys, thank you for having me back. I appreciate it. Will the Habs trade away Matheson? I mean, I think that the Habs should keep him for next season, try and get his value up a little bit, and then try and trade him depending on the direction of where they're going next year, of course. But, I mean, they're trying to get younger and keep that core going and trying to just build up from there. Matheson, obviously being a veteran piece, I don't know if he's going to be able to stay in that position as defense on the Habs, especially with all the talent coming up. So I think that's what they're going to do. I think they're going to keep him next season, and maybe if he doesn't play the full season, they'll trade him during but before the trade deadline. And if he does play the full season, well, then they'll probably trade him next offseason.
Question number two. Why do or don't you think the Habs should or shouldn't trade for Trevor Zegras?
Boy, this is a very fun question about Trevor Zegras. I mean, there's been a little bit of speculation about should the Habs trade for Zegras or not. And I'm thinking to myself, what could or should the Habs give up for him? It's always a tough question for me. I think Zegras would be a great addition. I mean, I know him and Cole Caufield have are good friends and have played before together on or to one extent or another, rather. So I think it would be a pretty good move to trade for Zegras, him being a younger, a relatively younger player.
Question number three. Why do or don't you think the Habs should or shouldn't be a more physical team next season?
I think here's the thing with the Habs' physicality. They have a few players that are physical, and there are certain players that are not physical. And I think that the Habs certainly need to become a more physical team. I think that, as you can see from this year's playoffs, Washington was a very physical team. Montreal was physical to an extent, but you can tell Washington was an extremely physical team. Florida, the same thing, a very physical team. The Habs, and no doubt in my mind, should the Habs become a more physical team next season. It's just the way the game is played these days. You have to be able to hit and, you know, make sure you win those 50-50 puck battles and use your body, use your force to try and knock someone off the puck. So I think that definitely the Habs have to become a more physical team if they want to be more successful.
Question number four. Why do or don't you think the Habs should or shouldn't be a more defensively minded team next season?
Here's what I think. Defense wins championships. I think that statement's true. Of course, you need a good offensive lineup. You need to be able to score goals in the playoffs because the goaltending is top tier. And I think that the Habs have a relatively good offense. And I think their defense, there's certain things that could be improved, but those improvements are coming very, very quickly, in my opinion. I mean, you look at the Habs, they're a young team, right? They're a young team defensively. David Savard is retiring now. You have guys like Owen Beck coming up into the league, and I think that with those extra additions, the Habs will become defensive or more of a defensive-minded team. I think the Habs should become a little bit more defensively-minded team, so that way they can be able to control their game offensively and have a good offensive rush, but also on defense, they're still able to be steady and help out the goaltending.
Question number five. Why do or don't you think the Montreal Canadiens do or don't need to make some big off-season signings before next season?
Here's the thing. Montreal is past the rebuilding stage now, as you can tell. Or at least getting towards the end of it, rather. And this team is going to be a much better team, I think, heading into next season, heading into the season after that, etc., and onward. I don't think it's the time to make huge off-season signings, just because I don't think they're fully equipped to say, even if we make a huge signing, we're going to win the Stanley Cup next season. I just don't think that's the way they're going, that's the direction they're going. I think it's a step-by-step progress every year. This season, they exceeded expectations, they made the playoffs. Next season, maybe they'll win a round of the playoffs. Season after that, they'll have a deep playoff run, and then maybe they'll have a good chance at the Cup. So I think that they're not going to make too many big off-season signings before next season.
Elias, we really appreciated your insightful responses, and we're looking forward to having you join us once again on the pod in the very near future.
Let's take it over now to the PWHL. A big congratulations is in order for the Minnesota Frost, earning their second straight Walter Cup trophy with a 2-1 overtime victory over the Ottawa Charge in Game 4 of the PWHL Finals. Liz Sheppers was the overtime hero for the Frost as she netted the championship winning goal for the second year in a row, sending a roaring crowd of over 11,000 fans to their feet in Minnesota. It took 12 minutes of overtime action for the Frost to bury the game winner and secure their second straight Walter Cup. Maddie Rooney made 33 saves in her fifth straight playoff win between the pipes for the Frost, tying the PWHL record for the most wins in a single postseason. The Frost hoisted the cup in front of a home crowd for the first time after last season's victory came on the road in Boston. Minnesota finished the regular season in fourth and in the final playoff spot, clinching their position on the final day of the regular season and tied with Ottawa at 44 points in the standings. Ottawa took game one of the finals, but Minnesota went on to secure three consecutive overtime victories on the way to the championship. The PWHL's expansion in 2025, their draft for the expansion draft, will be held on June 9th. Last month, and as we spoke about, the league announced an expansion in the West Coast with Vancouver and Seattle beginning next season. Each of the original six PWHL teams will give up four players from their 24-25 rosters for the draft, and teams will protect three players during the exclusive signing window and for the draft. After giving up two players, the teams can protect one additional player. The protection lists are due on June 3rd at noon during the expansion draft. Seattle and Vancouver will draft a minimum of seven players until they have reached a 12-player roster. If either team enters the draft with less players signed, the team have additional picks until they have reached 12 players. Very exciting here for the PWHL. Big congratulations again to the Minnesota Frost for a great season. A lot of overtime action for the PWHL during this playoff run. Great to see a lot of great hockey, and there's definitely more to come. We'll see what happens with the expansion draft that's coming up in a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Nick, a lot of exciting things going on in the PWHL. Now, let's transition from the ice and take it to the diamond. Steven, take it away.
The Toronto Blue Jays get their fourth win in a row as they beat the Oakland A's 8-7 in Saturday's game. The bad news coming out of this game is Dalton Varsho came out of the game with what looked like a hamstring injury. The team is saying hamstring discomfort, but it looked more than discomfort from here. I hope he's not out for too long, but if he is, we'll have Alan Roden step in and get some more playing time. The Jays didn't have as much luck with the bullpen day as they did the last time they had one. Braden Fisher had a rough time, giving up a three-run home run in the first and then a two-run homer in the same inning. Five earned in 1.1 innings will mess with your ERA for sure. Fisher came into the game with a 0.0 ERA in seven games with the Jays and left with a 4.66 ERA after this game. Easton Lucas came in to be the bulk guy and gave up three straight hits to load the bases but got out of the second. After that, he was good. He went 4.2 with just four hits. He also had one walk and three strikeouts. Good job from a pitcher who hasn't earned my trust yet. He came into the game with the 7.41 ERA and left with a 5.82 ERA. Brandon Little started the seventh and struggled to find the strike zone. He gave up a hit and two walks and getting two outs before giving it to Yariel Rodriguez, who got out of the inning without allowing any runs to score and threw a quick eighth. Jeff Hoffman picked up his 13th save despite a two-out, two-run home run, bringing the tying run to the plate. He then also gave up a double, but Ernie Clement made a great diving grab of a sinking liner, diving to his right to pick it just off the ground. It would have been a tie game if that had gone through to the outfield, so that's a clutch catch. The Jays in this series have somehow have figured out A, how to score, and B, how to hit home runs, two things that go together very well and are crucial for winning. The Jays hopefully can sweep the A's on Sunday and then start a series versus the Phillies on Tuesday.
Yeah, absolutely, Steven. Some good performances by the Blue Jays in recent times. Now, let's transition from the diamond and take it to the pitch. Let's talk some footy. Palmer leads Chelsea to win over Betis in Conference League final. Chelsea sparked into life in the second half as they came from behind to win the Conference League with a 4-1 victory over Real Betis. Their revival inspired by the creativity of Cole Palmer. Goals from Enzo Fernandez and Nicholas Jackson both set up by the excellent Palmer, plus late strikes from Jadon Sancho and Moises Caicedo, secured the silverware after Betis went in 1-0 up at halftime thanks to an early Abde Ezzalzouli strike. The 23-year-old Palmer's 2 assists in 5 minutes during the second half turned the match around for Premier League club Chelsea, and his effort saw him named player of the match. Chelsea have become the first team to win all 5 UEFA club tournaments, the Champions League, Europa League, Conference League, Super Cup, and the defunct Winners' Cup. Betis appeared nervous in the opening minutes, but eventually went in front when Isco found the unmarked Ezzalzouli at the edge of the box in the 9th minute, giving him plenty of time to break the deadlock with a powerful low shot. Chelsea seized control of the second half. In the 65th minute, Fernandez slipped between 2 defenders to head home across from Palmer for the equalizer. 5 minutes later, the match had completely turned around when Palmer went past his marker near the byline to again deliver a cross that enabled Jackson to bundle the ball into the net off his chest and put Chelsea ahead. Substitute Sancho made it 3-1 when he cut inside and curled a delightful shot into the far corner. Moises Caicedo then made it 4-1 in added time with a low shot from the edge of the box. PSG rout Inter Milan in record win for first title. PSG won their first Champions League title Saturday with a 5-0 win over Inter Milan, the biggest winning margin in the final of the competition dating to 1956, and sealed the treble after already winning Ligue 1 and the Coupe de France. PSG went ahead with the earliest goal in a Champions League final since 2019 with a move of speed and precision when Vitinha's threaded pass into the box found the feet of Doué. The forward could have shot but instead slid in Hakimi to tap into an open net. 8 minutes later and the lead was doubled. Though, this time it relied more on luck than precision, as Doué's shot from the right of the box deflected off Federico Di Marco and passed Inter goalkeeper Yann Sommer. He got his second in the 63rd, sliding the ball into the bottom corner. PSG added a 4th 10 minutes later, and Mayulu then found the back of the net in the 86th, just 2 minutes after coming on, to add his name to the list of teenage scorers in a final. The 5th goal made it the most one-sided win in the final of Europe's top competition, surpassing 4-0 victories for Inter's city rivals AC Milan in 1994 and 1989, and a win by the same margin by Bayern Munich in 1974. Sticking with the soccer theme, let's bring in sports correspondent Nicholas Lampiris to continue our conversation about the world's game. Question number 1. Why do or don't you think Nottingham Forest will or won't be contenders to win the Conference League next season?
I do think Nottingham Forest will be a contender, a serious contender for the UEFA Conference League next season, having just missed out of a top 6 spot this year in the Premier League and having really been in that top 4 race all year up until the last few games where they kind of just let off the gas a little bit and lost momentum. I do think they have a strong squad. I think they'll keep a lot of the players they have now. A really important factor on whether or not they stay successful or be successful in the Conference League, I think, is down to whether they can keep hold of Morgan Gibbs-White, which is basically their star attacking midfielder, who's received interest from the likes of, I know, Man City for sure, so he could be rumored to leave the club. But if he stays, I think they have a very strong chance of winning. If he doesn't, they can definitely use that money to replace him. And It's not the first time a Premier League team has won the Conference League. Chelsea just won it this year, and West Ham won it a few years ago as well. So obviously Premier League teams do well in this competition. And yeah, I really think that Nottingham Forest will have a good chance. I think they'll be better than most of the teams in that competition, or just around the same playing field. Like, I definitely think they can make the knockouts, maybe get to the round of 16, quarterfinals, for sure. But it's just they have to keep their star players like Alanga, Hudson-Odoi, and Gibbs-White. I think if they can keep all their star players and not let go of anyone and make some improvements in the summer, they'll for sure make it far.
Question number two. Why do or don't you think Kylian Mbappe will or won't score 50 goals in total across all competitions next season?
I think Mbappe will for sure hit the 50 goal mark next season across all competitions. Like, if you look at it this year, he won the Pichichi with 31 goals, and he had 7 in the Champions League, and he had a few more in the other competitions. So I think overall this year, I think he had around like 40-something goals, and that was on a disappointing Real Madrid season. They went trophyless this year. Really, just not really a good season for them. They lost to Barcelona in the title race, crashed out of the Champions League to Arsenal in embarrassing fashion, and lost the Copa del Rey as well. Like, I think that Mbappe for sure, like, Real Madrid will bounce back. Like, they already signed Trent. They already signed Dean Huijsen from Bournemouth, promising young center back. And Ancelotti's leaving the club. I think they're going to shake some things up quickly. Like, Real Madrid, that's a failure of a season for them. And the fact that Mbappe in his first season in that atmosphere got a little over 40 goals, Real Madrid, I think, will bounce back, and he'll for sure hit 50 next year, without a doubt in my mind. Like I said, he almost hit 50 this year in a very bad and that's a very bad Real Madrid season to their standard. So imagine a decent or good season, he's going to for sure get 50, in my opinion.
Nicholas, thank you so much for being here once again on another podcast episode. We really enjoyed your insightful responses, and we're looking forward to having you join us once again on the next episode. Now, transitioning from the pitch, let's take it to the court and let's talk some hoops. Olympiacos comes up trumps over Panathinaikos in third place game, 97-93. The Reds ended their final four weekend with a victory. Olympiacos signed off from the 2025 EuroLeague Final Four in style by grabbing a 97-93 win over Panathinaikos in the third place game. The Reds got off to a 7-0 start and ended up leading the entire way, but the fans of both teams remained engaged throughout as they cheered on their teams. Alec Peters paced Olympiacos with 32 points, a new club record at the Final Four, and tied for the most all-time in a Final Four game in the modern era, while Sasha Vezenkov bounced back with 23 points, and Moses Wright, who didn't feature in the semifinals, netted 19 points. Luka Vildoza and Thomas Walkup both went scoreless, but they finished with 9 and 8 assists, respectively. Panathinaikos was led by Omer Yurtseven's 23 points, followed by 14 for Sidi Osman and 12 for Matthias Lazort. Lorenzo Brown dished 12 assists. It was Olympiacos which started the better, as Peters, Evan Fournier, and Vezenkov put the Red 7-0 ahead. Lorenzo Brown got Panathinaikos on the board, then Konstantinos Mitoglou, Yurtseven, and Nunn combined to cut the deficit to 4 points, 12-8. Vezenkov and Peters struck from downtown as the Reds pushed the lead to 20-10. Vezenkov kept charging the move, the score to 26-12. Peters stayed hot too, while a couple of late right scores made it a 15-point ball game, 33-18. Kendrick Nunn closed the first quarter by moving to 7 points, which meant he is the first player in EuroLeague history to score 18 points in one season. It was 33-20 after 10 minutes. Panathinaikos found a response in the second quarter as Alexandros Samadurov knocked down a 3-pointer, then 4 points by Lazort and 5 by Osman made things interesting at 36-32. Samodurov and Jerian Grant responded to Olympiakos 42-38. But right, Sabin Lee and Vezenkov stepped up as the Reds went 57-42 ahead. The Greens had back-to-back scores to finish the second quarter. However, as none converted before, Tibor Pleiss had a putback dunk to cut the gap to 57-46 at the interval. Yurtseven and Osman joined forces to put more pressure on Olympiakos in the early stages of the third frame, 60-52, but Fournier's triple and Mustafa Fall's dunk ensured it was a double-digit difference again, 66-54. Yurtseven, Osman, and Mitoglou brought it within 5 points, 67-62, but Peters and Vezenkov were there to keep things calm for Olympiakos, which led 75-64 heading into the final quarter. Any hopes of a Panathinaikos comeback were put on hold as Vezenkov and Lee responded to a Grant 3, 81-69, and again when Peters struck from three-point land before Wright scored inside at 86-72. Yannoulis Ladizakis' triple looked like it could have been the closer at 89-76, but there was still life in last year's champion as Panathinaikos went on a 16-4 run to make it very interesting. At 93-90, Ladizaki hit a couple of free throws with 7 seconds left, 95-90. Then Panathinaikos converted from deep to make it 95-93, but Peters had a perfect trip to the line as Olympiakos grabbed a 97-93 win. And that'll do it for episode 51 of Spirited Sports. Thank you to Elias Drakos for joining us as our special guest, for Nicholas Lampiris for being here with us as sports correspondent, and thank you to Nicholas DeChico and Stephen Lucas for co-hosting alongside me. And last but not least, thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in once again.